From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. You are you, and you are here, and that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. Of course, where would we be without our super producer, Paul Deccant?
Mission Control.
That is one of his many, many names. I asked Paul how many names he had one time, and in my head he said, my names are Legion.
But in reality, he just looked at you and shook his head and walked away.
Yeah.
He's a very cryptic creature. Yeah.
If we didn't have Mission Control, we'd just be floating out here in space amongst all these conspiracies and mysteries.
Rudderless.
Not knowing what we're doing. Mm-hmm. There's no systems control. Like, who's watching? I don't know. Let's name a system. The variable flight channel conduit.
Yeah.
Well, was that? Is that an acronym?
I don't know.
No. He's getting the techno babble.
Yeah, I don't know the terms, but if we would just be aimless,
we would be aimless, and we could potentially be hit, you know, broadsided, dare we say, by some sort of conspiracy asteroid cluster.
Right.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing about this is that we're talking about surprises today. We're talking about unpleasant surprises. And along the way, we're going to bust a few myths, I would say, that we in the U.S. tend to have about our fine neighbors to the north, the Canadians.
This one's kind of fun though, right?
Yeah, this is not going to be one of those where you turn off your podcast listening device and sit in the dark for a while, hopefully.
Yeah.
We got an email the other day where someone was like, hey, guys, love you, but can you tone it down a little bit?
Yeah.
It's been kind of heavy.
Give us something silly or weird.
Here we go.
So Canada is the Commonwealth country to the north of the continental United States, and it is often depicted as the more friendly side of North American culture.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you've ever traveled abroad, depending upon the political climate of the place you visit, you'll hear a lot of Americans, myself included, pretend to be Canadian.
Sure.
It was a little easier before the advent of the internet.
They're like the Swiss, you know?
They're just
sort of neutral, friendly, earth-respecting neighbors to the north.
Just sew a patch on your backpack that has a maple leaf, away you go.
Considerable contributions to American comedy.
No doubt.
Oh,
are you kidding
God,
me?
God, yes.
The best.
My goodness.
It's weird. It's sort of the way that some of the best literature in the English language is written by Russians. Some of the best comedy in the English language, or some of the best comedy in the U.S. at least, is made entirely by Canadians.
On par with the Brits, but you also have a lot of like Canadian expats that go to places like Chicago and the whole Second City thing. Mm-hmm. But then you have, you know, your Kids in the Hall and all that. But really, really influential stuff.
And it's no surprise that people would see Canada as a more friendly version of the U.S. Because despite sharing a common tongue and despite the fact that we're on the same continent, we have this enormous, relatively friendly land border, Canada and the U.S. are two related, but more importantly, two very different cultures. Like the U.S., the Canadian government was heavily concerned with the possibility of the Cold War becoming an active, open conflict pretty much after World War II ended and on.
Well, and specifically because they have a proximity problem where if it becomes a hot war.
That's true. Up there in Canada's northwest, right?
Yeah. Nuclear fallout would find its way to them if the U.S. got bombed.
So that's one of our myths that we find in the very beginning of this show, this stereotype of all Canadian people somehow being the nicest, kindest people on earth, and that somehow equating to a super nice, super kind government.
Ah, yes, okay.
I think the operative term you just used there, Ben, is on earth. No one is safe from assholes on this planet.
Or, you know, self-serving needs for a government a military.
I'm just saying it's easy to lump a group of people in and say, you know, with a sample size of the few Canadians I've met in person or seen on television. Mm. They're all like that, obviously. Yeah, no, there's the same avarice and weirdness and self-servingness that, you know, you see everywhere else on this planet.
But of course, if you're listening to this and are currently in Canada or are from Canada, we are assured that you are probably one of the nicest people listening to the show right now.
Specifically you.
Yes,
of course.
Yeah. So thank you.
By association, we're all hanging out together. We're all the best.
So the thing is, in the past, we have looked at some of the skeletons in Uncle Sam's closet. We've done so at length. We've found some terrifying stuff. We found some entirely absurd stuff. Right, mm-hmm. Like the various plans to kill Castro and so on, which are just Rube Goldberg-esque. And today we're looking at something that a lot of U.S. citizens are probably not aware of, or possibly not aware of, which is that the Canadian government was at heart no different from the U.S. government. They found themselves doing some absurd things to address the fear of the spread of communism. And the story that we encounter today would honestly be, in my opinion, hilarious were it not true and disturbing. This may contain language that some folks in the audience might find offensive. Just want to put that out there. Because what do we always hear? It was a different time.
It was a different time.
Right.
And the time we're talking about is in the late 50s and early 60s.
Right. Yeah. Canada had a problem. They were trying to make sure that they did not have moles, leakers, spies, right? And they were doing all the things a government does to try to prevent that. Background checks, investigations, running your financial records. But they thought there was a particular group of people that was an active national security threat. People who were attracted to the same gender.
I'm sorry, why?
They thought that homosexuality was a huge threat because they essentially thought these people would be easy to turn. In the 50s, early 60s, Canada's security panel told the prime minister at the time, John Diefenbaker, that, quote, gay people needed to be removed from public office because they are weak, unreliable, and easily compromised.
So he sees them as like degenerates or in some way having no scruples, you know?
In my opinion, I think it's because there was such social stigma about being homosexual at that time that it would make you prone to blackmail.
Oh, that's certainly a
side
of it.
Dirt on you.
I gotcha. Yeah. So you think that's the main thing?
I mean, I think that's one of them. There are several, but one of them is to that effect.
But the language, though, here seems to imply a almost personal resentment of said individuals.
Yeah, because I think the government is composed of people that live within the society they attempt to govern, so they suffer from that same stigma.
These guys are outliers. These people are, you know,
So I think it's hand in hand. It might be one of those. It may have been one of those things where the official reasons were presented as these people could be blackmailed, but the internal emotional motivation was like, don't trust them.
Get them out. Don't want them.
Don't like them. I'm against it. Those are two of our
– the Canadian redneck voice.
Two of our completely accurate Canadian voices here. Canadian redneck voices.
It's just like that, but it's followed by A.
Right.
No, that's bad.
Well, I think we'll run into some more accents along the way. They took this so seriously that they formed a special group within the RCMP, which stands for, of course
– the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Mm-hmm.
We had an off-air discussion about this, too.
Yeah. Like, are they – like, the mountedness of them, is that a requirement? Is that a sign of respect? Do they ride moose?
Oh, sure. Yes.
Which part?
All of it.
No. I was wrong about the moose. It's fine. You can take me to task. Please, in fact. I insist.
I'll let our Canadian –
brethren.
Yeah, the person listening to this right now that is typing the email.
It's going
to
be so polite and friendly, though, just shredding me in the most low-key way.
Hey, yeah, we don't ride the moose anymore.
They never did. It was a horse thing, right?
Yeah.
Just get a brief history of the Canadian, Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating.
Only sergeants and above are allowed to mount the moose.
And today,
misinfo.
This is an active law enforcement agency. They prevent, investigate crime. They maintain peace and order, enforce laws. They contribute to national security even today.
Mm-hmm.
And they at this time were also incredibly concerned about what they saw as the spread of communism through the compromise of closeted homosexual officials in their organization, in any government organization, so much so that they formed a task force for this with the name Section A3. Section A3's only job was to identify and fire every and any homosexual working for the Canadian government in any capacity.
So this is like some McCarthyism witch hunt kind of toxic work environments here.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yikes. It's a great comparison. Yeah. Ugh. So to do this, they said we need to find concrete proof of someone's sexual identity or their orientation or whatever their sexuality might be. And that's where it got very strange very quickly, because they at least had enough self-respect or dignity to say, well, we can't just go around calling people gay and then firing them. We have to have some sort of proof.
Right.
But they didn't tell leadership officially. They didn't tell leadership at the time exactly what kind of means they were going to use to arrive at that end.
Right. Like, is it enough that you find a Liza Minnelli record in their collection? Is that – no. We need more.
Well, yeah. And this is – there's a tough amount of basically reconnaissance and spying you have to do to prove someone outside of the workplace lives a certain way or thinks a certain way, right?
So invasive.
It's really – they did some weird stuff to try and figure out.
Yeah. And so the prime minister did not know the full extent of this project. He accepted their advice, and – we have to remember we have the benefit of being alive in 2018 for however long that remains a benefit. So this might seem backwards to us, but moral panics were really common back in the day.
Was this almost like a black ops kind of situation where it was like, get it done by whatever means necessary? I don't need to know all the details from the prime minister's perspective.
You know, that's a question that I would love to hear somebody else's take on, because, you know, how much of that is him really not knowing, and how much of that is exactly what you described, him saying, well, plausible deniability.
Yeah. Just get it done.
Don't talk to me directly. Talk to this guy.
You probably called them fellas.
Well, yeah. I would say that this program in general had to have high levels of secrecy involved with it, because you can't let the people know that they are hunting for your sexuality in that way, right? Or else you just – then maybe you don't go to the bar, or you don't associate with certain people.
That's right, especially if you're in the government and you could hear through the grapevine that this is going on. They would have to really keep it under wraps.
Yeah, especially if you know your job is at risk.
Yeah. So what kind of stuff did they do?
Well, there were several tactics that they used, but one that we know about from a CBC.ca article that included a video interview – they would post up outside known gay bars, such as the basement bar of the Lord Elgin Hotel near the University of Ottawa in Ottawa.
Remember that part.
Yes. And they would take photographs of everyone entering and exiting the facility, the establishment. And they'd seek the assistance of known gay men, such as Paul Fournier, who at the time was a famous drag performer who went by Peaches Latour.
I love that name.
Yes, exactly. And they would ask somebody like Paul Fournier to identify the people in the photograph. So they'd get Paul in, sit him down in a room with a giant, just hundreds and hundreds of photographs of people, and say, who are these people? Do you recognize them? And then find out if those people worked for the government. Pretty crazy. By the way, Peaches Latour at the time would do a show for about $3,000 a night.
Wow. In the 50s?
Yeah. So now, keep that number.
Should we inflation calculator that?
Just keep that number in your head as we continue this episode. $3,000 for a single night of performance.
I mean, that's
$100,000.
It's more than $30,000 for sure. Yeah.
But to his credit, according to the interview, Fournier refused to help the RCMP in their efforts, and for that, he was labeled a security threat and a traitor to his country.
Just like from Noel's example with McCarthyism, just like the entertainment industry folks in the U.S. who refused to say so-and-so is a communist.
Yes.
And they were thinking, well, the only reason that you're not telling us that this person is a communist or gay is because you, sir, are a traitor.
Yeah, exactly. Or both of those things and all of those things. And, you know, it's just – it's pretty gnarly.
And this was super expensive work, right?
Oh, yeah. Crazy expensive. So much time on the books of people sitting outside, standing outside of places, taking photographs. Yeah. You're talking about the film that
– Stakeouts.
To do all that stuff.
I mean,
you're talking
seriously.
About.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
man hours.
The man hours.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like, think about how much effort – it's like imagine yourself being like a National Geographic's nature photographer or like someone that works on one of those Planet Earth documentaries. Think how long they had to sit up in that tree before that alligator like made that move just right. Same deal with humans, you know?
Yeah.
And one thing that's interesting, which is a little bit lost to history in this story, is that when they were relying on human intelligence – they also used underground informants or kind of sting agents. So that's a weird position to me. If you're quote unquote hunting these people and there's some guy in the locker room going, to catch the beast, you must become the beast.
And then saying that over and over to himself in the mirror.
Right. And he – I just say that person is in the pole position to never be fired or found out, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you can already see the ethical quandaries with this ridiculous plan. But because of the expense and because of the perceived lack of efficacy with this stuff, they decided to go a more technologically advanced route. And they ultimately built something called, their term, not ours, the fruit machine.
And we'll learn about that right after a quick word from our sponsor.
The fruit machine, yes, it's a real name. And this concept took off primarily due to the efforts of a psychology professor named Frank Robert Wake, who was working at the university in Ottawa, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the government recruited Wake and sent him to the U.S. for a year to study the, quote, homosexual detection measures that were being developed in the States.
Can we just say up front real quick so we don't even have to mess with it again? The idea of calling it the fruit machine, that's already a term of abuse. I mean, that's a very kind of like looking down the nose at an entire segment of the population. Calling, you know, homosexuals fruits is a very outdated and outmoded nasty bit of slang.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Absolutely. That's why we've got to have that disclaimer at the top, you know.
Yeah.
And even the concept of, quote, homosexual detection measures is pretty problematic.
Problematic and hilarious.
Yeah.
As we will discover.
Yeah.
So they sent this professor, Frank Robert Wake, to the U.S. to learn this stuff. And they paid him for all of these efforts to do this thing, to build the fruit machine. They paid him $5,000.
For the year.
Yeah. They paid him $5,000 to do this. Meanwhile, Peaches Latour's over there. She's like, two nights. And I already make more than you.
And that's that $5,000 is in today's dollars approximately or a little bit more than $40,000. So in the States, Wake finds this study that an American university professor had recently done not to punish people for their sexual orientation, but to figure out what they buy in a grocery store. Mm. It's pretty interesting stuff. So he straps a camera, the American professor, to subjects' heads, and he measures their pupil dilation as they walk through a grocery store to see what product packaging attracts their attention most.
Oh, wow.
Is it like a dopamine reaction where it's like, I'm excited about this, so my body chemistry is acting a certain way?
That's what they were going for, yeah. Some kind of correlation between dilation and interest.
Right. Interesting.
Interesting. Yeah, the science is not perfect.
No,
because, you know, we can get into it. Yeah. So Wake decided this would be the perfect basis for his project.
Great.
In his mind, he thought, well, if this tells us what sort of cereal and macaroni boxes people enjoy, then surely this will tell us how they like to get busy.
Flash some ripped deltoids their way and see what happens.
So he thought, yeah, exactly that. He thought, I will create a camera that will measure subjects' pupils as dirty images flash. Some of the images will be completely innocuous, like a picture of an apple or something. And then some will be a little bit more flirty, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if their pupils dilate in a certain way when they see a sexually charged image of someone of the same gender, then they are automatically a homosexual.
So I'm sorry, just to backtrack a step. Is this something that someone would have to be brought in to have this test administered to them? Or is this something they could like do on people out in the wild?
Well, let us tell you. So we're talking about a chair. Really, that's how you start. If we're gonna talk about the administration of the fruit machine test,
yeah,
there's a chair.
It's like a chair you would be in at a visit to the dentist office.
Then there's some questions while you're sitting on that chair. Then they're gonna have a display of some sort that's gonna show those images that mm-hmm. Ben was talking about.
Yeah,
and you really just you sit there and you experience it.
But what's the pretense for bringing these people in? And it seems like such an odd set of tests to you know, how do you explain this away?
Oh, we'll get there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in theory, this apparatus, as Wake was imagining it, would not just measure their eyes, it would measure as many physiological variables as possible. Are you sweating? Are you shaking? What's your pulse? That kind of stuff.
Similar to a lie detector test, the way they check all those things.
Which are also bullshit.
Or like the replicant test from Blade Runner.
Exactly. Yeah. Why don't you help the turtle turn over, right?
Exactly.
So they would connect those responses and correlate these multiple responses to the images on the screen. And again, this is like the late 50s, early 60s. So think of when you think of a picture that would be a racy or attractive picture of whatever you're into, translate that to the 50s. If you're into like muscular dudes, then think some guy in like an animal pelt who looks like he walked out of a circus with some dumbbells.
Or maybe just in shorts.
Or maybe
showing a little knee.
Yeah. And their bulge.
A little bulge.
Mm-hmm.
Or his little knee bulge.
His pants are too high, showing the devil's wrist.
Ooh, I don't even. Okay.
It's an ankle.
Okay. Yeah.
But I don't think that one's going to take off, to be honest with you guys. We should just keep calling them ankles. But yeah, that's the idea. And what a wacky idea, right? It's the same. It's on the level of building training bats to carry bombs. It's on the level of what was that weird testosterone or gay bomb mm-hmm. that the Pentagon mm-hmm. worked on.
Everyone was high on amphetamines at the time. They were just spitballing stuff.
More and more, I'm starting to wonder if you're right about that.
I mean, seriously, man. Like, think about it. It's sort of like what you hear about, you know, bad 80s records that came out. It's like, who greenlit this? A room full of executives high on cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, yeah.
You know what?
True to this day.
Yeah. You know what? I like the part of the song where it just says, hey, Mickey.
You're so fine?
You know what? That's crazy, but let's do that. Let's just do that for the whole – you're blowing my mind right now. Hang on. Wait. I completely, as everyone can tell, agree with you, Noel, about 80s – some of those 80s records. But the thing about these ridiculous proposals in government is usually they never make it past the drawing board.
Yeah.
Somebody says, hey, guys, I know we've been in a room for a while – so what if we could turn cats into robots that would be spies for us? And someone's like, I really don't think – I mean, put it on the board. Fine. We need 10 ideas. And those things never get built, right?
Usually.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where it gets crazy. the Canadian government did actually build this machine, and they actually used it.
And they actually called it the fruit machine.
And they actually called it the fruit machine, but only with the people who are in the know.
Yes.
Because, as we'll find out, most of the subjects who were tested were not in the know. In practice, the test was not as comprehensive as it was in theory. It primarily used that pupil area response as an indicator of a person's sexual orientation, and they also measured pulse and sweat, but that was it.
Yep.
They would sit subjects down in that dentist-style chair that you described, Matt, and they would be shown those images. You know, think of what, like a vase with flowers, and then like a person showing a little side boob or whatever. And when the pupils dilated during the display of an erotic photograph, that would be registered as sexual attraction. And so if the subject's eyes dilate when shown photos of people of the same gender, then boom, they're assumed to be homosexual.
Yeah. So we, Noel, you asked about the science. Like, why would that be a thing? Like, how does that function? Aren't there other reasons that somebody's pupils might dilate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the amount of light entering them, perhaps?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. So if the difference from one slide to another is extreme enough or large enough, their pupils are going to dilate naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a really, really bright pastel picture, let's say that vase with flowers again, or like a badger or something. And then it cuts to a darker picture of someone being sultry, then your pupils are going to dilate because there's less light.
Yeah, just what kind of lighting are they using in the sultry images? That's what we're talking about. Is there a key light? Are we, you know, is it three light setup? Like, are they kinos?
Which means you could. Which
are
means,
we talking about LEDs here? Like, you know.
Which means you could totally rig the test if you wanted to get someone in trouble.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, is there any indication scientifically that this dilation thing really is one-to-one correlated with these emotional responses? Like, I know that certain drugs will make your pupils do certain things, but that seems like a very immediate and intense reaction. I just wonder, like, what the science is here, if there really even is any sand to it.
There are some physiological reactions, fight or flight kind of stuff.
Sure.
That will get you pumped, and arousal can fall into that category. Yeah,
but it's like there's shades of it, I imagine.
Right. Well, so just because someone's eyes widen doesn't necessarily mean they're digging you.
And I also feel like, you know, showing a dude wearing some shorts versus a phallus, for example, you're going to get two different reactions.
Yeah.
And especially in the 50s, I think people would audibly be going.
Their heads would have exploded.
Yeah, right? Whether or not they were into it.
Yeah.
Because now we're talking about ambushing people with dick pics,
mm-hmm.
for quote-unquote national security. Mm-hmm.
I still want to know what the pretense is that they've got these folks in this chair.
Yeah. So before we get to that, we have to say they use these other tests too. Check this one out. They would monitor subjects' physiological responses, again, dilation, pulse, sweat, probably a little bit of body language too, when these subjects heard certain words. So there would be someone testing you.
These would be like trigger words, essentially.
Right, right. So there'd be someone testing you, and they would say things like queer, gay, drag, bar.
Yeah, even the word bar, to see how they respond to that. It's interesting. And I don't think we had a full list of the words they used, because they probably had control words as well and a bunch of other things. But
yeah.
So it feels a bit strange there, too.
And super subjective.
Yeah.
So the other thing that makes this conspiratorial in addition to ridiculous is that they lied to the test subjects.
Yes.
Finally answering that question.
Ah.
They completely lied to them. They told government employees that the test was meant to measure your stress levels. So you sit down, they plug you into the things, mm-hmm. they monitor your pulse, your sweat, and your dilation. They say, we're just going to show you a series of pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to say anything.
Yeah.
Just lay here and look at these. And then while you're laying there, perhaps they go, also, gay, drag, bar.
Communist.
Right. You know?
And of course, there's no sense from anybody. They've done a good job of keeping this gay witch hunt under wraps, because people would not be any the wiser if they're getting pulled in for this slightly weird set of battery of tests, right?
They kept it under wraps ostensibly until the first person was decided. It was decided that the first person failed the test. And then that person found out.
Because they were too stressed, right, would be the first official explanation. But you're right. It's an unsustainable situation. And we'll examine what happened next after a word from our sponsors. Yeah, so there are a bunch of problems with this machine. Primarily in the fact that word gets out. How many people get fired immediately for stress? And in addition to that, the fruit machine itself had some problems. So as soon as people realize there's something sketchy about this quote-unquote stress machine, getting people to take the test became nearly impossible. Even if you didn't know it was some sort of examination or attempt to examine people's sexuality, you would know something's up.
Yeah.
Everybody's got dirt, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like when you get called in for that second pee test at your job and you're like, uh-oh.
They know I used a fake phallus.
They know I ate that poppy seed muffin.
Right, oh, yeah. But
never do that.
Exactly.
Never do that.
No. Which just part?
Eat a poppy seed muffin?
Yeah.
Or to take a drug test?
Let's say poppy seed.
Matt, did you see that someone wrote to us about your position on DNA and free speech?
No. I haven't read that yet.
We'll check it out.
Oh, no.
We're probably overdue for a listener mail.
Yeah, let's do it today.
Did I get taken down?
I hope so.
Oh.
I'm kidding.
No, you didn't get taken down. We got a lot of really interesting responses to the DNA questions that we posed earlier.
I just want to backtrack. I don't know why I said I hope so, Matt. I never want to see you taken down. But for some reason, I see you as being so infallible. I kind of like the idea of someone giving you a little stick in the ribs there. It's out of love, man.
No one is infallible.
That's true.
The darkest sides of me have yet to be revealed.
Ooh, cool. I like
and also,
this.
Nah.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll be on hold for evil Matt.
Cool.
Or is it more like a noir Matt?
Yeah.
He has a mustache.
Yeah.
He has a Matt stash.
I like it. Mm-hmm.
So, speaking of infallible and things that the fruit machine is not, it had a lot of mechanical failures, too.
Mm-hmm. A lot of them.
Which would add to stress. Like, sometimes the camera wouldn't work, the pulse readings were off, the people were still stuck in that chair. They have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, the projector would malfunction. Mm-hmm.
Ugh, embarrassing.
Yeah.
Get your stuff together, Canadian government.
To be fair, it had a lot of moving parts.
Why are you justifying that? Why are you defending the Canadian
government? I'm not defending the government. I'm defending our intrepid Mr. Wake, Professor Wake, attempted to make a very complex machine.
He was doing his best.
One would say unnecessarily complex. Yeah. Because the way people describe it now, it sounds ornate. It sounds like steampunk, honestly.
Yeah,
and it does.
Can we hear a little bit? I think I'm still having a hard time fully picturing this. I've got the dentist chair vibe, mm-hmm. but what's give me some other like steampunk elements here?
Oh, sure. There was always an operator, one of the operators, because it required three people at all times to be in the room.
Yeah,
right. There was one person who in the corner would be shoveling coal into.
You're lying.
Yeah, I'm lying,
Matt. And they're all wearing these gilded goggles at all times, right?
Yeah. Well, in honest depictions, people say that it looked like – people who saw it at the time said that it looked like something out of a sci-fi novel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just the chair. There's the sensory equipment. There are people operating it. And you are – you know, it's spooky. You're taken to a room – isolated by yourself. Your coworkers are probably still outside.
I'm picturing something like the Ludovico machine from Clockwork Orange.
That's
where Alex is sitting there and he's got his lids locked open and he's got the electrodes coming out and they're showing him imagery as well.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm going to choose to see it like that.
I think that's a good way to see it. And there's a little bit of controversy in the National Post when they reported on Canada's attempt to make Gaydar, journalist Jack Howen points out that the Canadian War Museum displays an electropsychometer. You know what that street name of that is, right?
Is it like the e-meters?
Yes, it's
yeah,
an e-meter.
Yeah.
So they yes, and well done. So the e-meter, according to the War Museum, was used to detect homosexuals during the Cold War, but the people who have investigated this, various authors who wrote books about the fruit machine and the Cold War hunt, they say that the e-meter was never used as part of that. So this means that right now, and this is still recent history, we have differing versions of what the machine actually did or was.
Jeez.
We have pretty solid evidence that the camera and the dilation thing was involved. And, you know, fight, arousal, pupils dilate like that. But they also dilate when the light changes. And because this thing kept breaking down, because it was the Edsel of psychological experiments, and because people pretty much found out that it was not a stress test, they eventually cut the funding for this particular part of the program. And the Royal Canadian Mounted Police's dream of having a gaydar to screen everybody was put on hold in 1967. So from late 50s to 1967. Mm-hmm. But this did not stop them from continuing their work, trying to root out these insidious, dangerous, or somehow morally questionable people from any government payroll. And they eventually started using a new type of machine.
Yeah, a plethysmograph?
Yeah, a plethysmograph, yeah.
Plethysmograph. This one makes a little more sense if you're specifically trying to figure out the sexual orientation of someone. However, it still has major, major flaws. And in this version, this test, it's checking out specifically blood flow to the genital region.
Sounds a little invasive, right?
Perhaps.
So, same thing, same great format from earlier, showing people pictures and seeing if they experience tumescence or increased blood flow to their mm-hmm. genitals.
Yeah, so we're not going up, you know, we're not looking at the messenger this time who might be the pupils or whatever. We're going straight to the source, the place where magic happens. I don't know. It makes more sense to do it that way. But still, like how on earth do you get somebody to do that unless you are compelling them to do it? Like you're going to lose your job if you don't take this test or.
Yeah. And there's still intervening variables because someone has to attach that equipment, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you say, just put this on yourself, position it snugly.
It's a massive HR nightmare.
Right. And that's one example, but there's more to this story because unfortunately, the conspiracy against homosexual people in Canada did not stop there. It picked up steam. The program that we talked about was shut down eventually after around 400 people lost their jobs.
400 people.
400. But wow. That's just the beginning because similar programs came into play and they continued. They eventually ruined thousands and thousands of careers in the military, the public service, and of course the RCMP. There was legalized discrimination against people in Canada for decades and decades and decades beyond the 50s. It didn't end, in fact, until the 1990s, which I think would surprise a lot of people in the U.S. who have, again, that sort of romanticized stereotype of Canada being all group hugs and smiles.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until November of 2017.
Last year, mm-hmm, as we record this.
That the government issued an official apology for what is now known as the Gay Purge.
Wow. Wow. And there is, by the way, video of that apology and some of the reaction to it that you can find online right now.
Yeah. Yeah. From Prime Minister Trudeau, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, too. I found an article called Vancouver Becomes the First Canadian City to Ban Anti-LGBT Conversion Therapy, and that's from June 6th, very recently. That's from a couple days ago. And yeah, as we know, conversion therapy is this notion of turning someone from homosexual into heterosexual through various means over time, everything ranging from like shock treatment to just very intensive psychotherapy. And it's very controversial. And for an entire city to actively pass legislation to outlaw this kind of is pretty forward thinking and progressive. So obviously, Canada's come a long way.
Yeah. And the Canadian government now plans to pay up to $110 million. This is around $85 million US to compensate victims of this purge. Is it going to be enough money? Is this even a situation where a little bit of scratch can gloss over the damage to your career, your personal life, your future, your relationships, quite possibly?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I don't think it is. Just for a little more information on that stuff. Yeah. So each individual person will be eligible to up to $150,000 Canadian dollars in compensation for this.
Up to.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the other big issues is that a lot of the people who were victims of this practice and this test and retaliation by the government have died at this point.
Yeah.
So they're going to put, I think, 15 million Canadian dollars towards an array of memorial measures for a lot of these people. So at least, you know, that's one thing. The legacy will be changed and altered and improved in some way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're also – I think they're also talking about – didn't they say something about expunging the record of certain things?
Yeah, unjust convictions from people charged under laws that criminalized their sexuality.
Yeah.
And we're not in any way saying that the U.S. is any better in this respect. And – it's true that even today in 2018, as many people know, people who do not identify by the, I guess, the prevalent gender binaries or sexuality mores of the world or the world in which we live at large, those people are still in tremendous danger in many countries.
Oh, you know? Yes. Physical danger.
And there are death penalties. So this is not – they're not sentencing these people to death. I mean, they are sentencing them to career death.
Yeah.
But this is a case where there was an active conspiracy against people whose only crime was something that they could not control. And, you know, we go back to this point. I think, Matt, you and I mentioned this a little bit off air with each other. But what do you guys think? Do you think that these people, given the social stigmas of the 50s and 60s, would have been a legit security risk?
I think there are so many reasons for someone to be a security risk because of their personal either hang-ups or interests or things that they do outside of the work environment. I think, yeah, there are all kinds of weaknesses. And that's one of those things that you can't really control for as a large organization like that. Yeah, absolutely. Everything from gambling habits.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's so many things.
That's like I was saying at the top of the show. There's obviously a much more personal vendetta against this type of stuff via the government than it was looked at as like specifically about being a security risk. Have you guys ever seen that movie, The Lives of Others? It's about Berlin. The Communist Party is like spying on everybody, and it's like 1984, dude. It's like kids are turning in their fathers and stuff like that, and you know, as outing them as being communists. So it's like it doesn't require a lot. It doesn't take a lot, you know, because everyone's got things to hide, whether it's this or any number of other things. So this was very clearly like they were trying to clean house of an undesirable type.
Well,
minds,
yeah. Yes, and I appreciate you say that because this comparison holds true for the entire sequence of events. But here's the other thing, and maybe I'm being a jerk about this, but when we see cases wherein an authority figure, whether appointed by the people or a religious authority figure, for instance, whenever we see cases where they're invasively obsessed with someone else's sexuality or practice, and they talk about how bad it is. And when it gets to a more and more extreme cartoonish degree, I start questioning that person.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Like, oh, yeah.
It's a pretty common trope here in the U.S. that when some of the politicians or religious figures who are super against any kind of, like, same-sex relationship are the same people who later get caught doing the things that they said were so terrible.
Abhorrent.
Yeah.
Right.
You know. Yeah. Oh, no, it's totally true. It's a definite trope. And you see it in movies like, for example, American Beauty, for example. The Colonel character played by Chris Cooper, who is so horrible to his son and, like, this guy, this, like, macho influence, and then it turns out that he is secretly gay. And that's certainly something – the way that manifests itself, that kind of self-loathing, it can become very toxic, and it can actually create whole movements within governments. You know, people that have power, they can change the tide of the way people are treated. You know, it's fascinating and terrifying.
And of course, we believe in empowerment. It is, to quote Spider-Man, both a power and a responsibility, or to paraphrase rather. And – fortunately, this concludes our episode on a happy note. Some sort of justice has been met.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are things perfect? Of course not. But are they moving in a better direction? Absolutely. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. We also hope to hear from you because, again, you, specifically you, are the best part of this show. But Why do we keep saying that? Let's put our money where our mouth is. Enough about us. What about you? You guys want to do some listener mail?
Oh, yeah.
Our first message comes from Austin, who says, "Hey, guys, my name is Austin, and I'm a longtime fan of the podcast. I was listening to your most recent episode on the Golden State Killer and have a quick anecdote for you regarding something you mentioned about the 23andMe ancestry DNA tests. The story is about something I believe Matt mentioned." Oh, boy. He was talking about a DNA test and finding out that your dad is not, in fact, your dad. "For privacy reasons, I won't mention how my family knows this person, but I do know someone who that exact scenario happened to. Here's where it gets crazy. The person took an ancestry DNA test, and when the results came back, she found out she had multiple siblings from her mother's previous sexual engagements, and she never knew about them. And her father was not her actual father. The people she'd considered her siblings her whole life were in fact only half siblings. This woman was in her 50s when she found this out. The parents admitted to this when she confronted them, and obviously the scenario is absolutely awful for the person involved, as it is highly emotional, and I can only imagine it breaks a family apart." Wow. Okay, that's heavy, Austin. "Anyways, I just thought I'd share this because it was mentioned directly on the show. Keep doing what you're doing, guys. I love the show." Then Austin says, he says, "We deserve raises, guys. That's kind of nice. You listening, bosses? We deserve raises.
They don't listen to the show, dude.
Yeah, give us some more money." Anyway, and then Austin says, "Keep it up." So thanks so much for writing in, Austin.
Austin, thank you so much for writing in. We've received a lot of interesting stuff regarding DNA in general, the math behind it, the science behind it, the ethical implications. And we want to thank not just you, Austin, but a lot of your fellow listeners who shared some very personal stories with us.
You got another good one for us, Ben?
Noel, I think you've got one for today.
I'll drop one here for you. This one was no subject, very eerie, and from an email address with that's just numbers.
Okay.
At mypixmessages.com. That's very, very strange. I thought it was maybe a bot at first. But no bot has this much tale to tell, let me tell you what. "Gentlemen, I have yet to listen to the latest podcast about the original Night Stalker because it's a difficult subject for me. I live in Anaheim in Southern California, where Richard Ramirez was committing these crimes. My boyfriend's father worked at an aluminum plant in Garden Grove, where he later realized the temp who was hired and quit, who talked about killing a woman and making a sandwich after, was actually the Night Stalker. People who heard him talk said they had just taken his stories with a grain of salt. To say people in our community were frightened is a huge understatement. Likewise, when this monster was caught by citizens, many wished the police had not intervened as quickly as they did." I'm thinking she's implying there would have been some sort of pitchfork brigade, lynch mob kind of situation. This man was a beast. I believe life in prison was a waste of taxpayer money. Needless to say, I was of an age when this serial killer's actions, among a few other incidents, had a horrific lingering effect on me. And then this person goes on to say, you have had some pretty heavy topics on the podcast lately, which I have listened to. I want to thank you for the research and work you do to keep us entertained, educated, and inquisitive. But could you please find a lighter topic or two to dive into in the coming weeks?
Hopefully this one satisfied that.
Hopefully so. We mentioned that at the top of the show as well. I'll chime in. Someday maybe I'll chime in on another topic and tell you about the other incidents which had an impact on me at that time in my life. Big fam, blessings. Lisa.
Yes. Thanks so much for writing, Lisa. And I also want to thank you personally for some of the great stuff that you have posted on Here's Where It Gets Crazy.
Oh, man.
Lisa is a regular contributor to the fan page.
I knew I recognized that name.
Yeah.
That fan community is so much fun. It's so rewarding. And I really love everyone's contributions. It's such a cool thing to go in and explore.
Again, absolutely. You all are the best part of the show.
No joke. And I just, this is something our social media team said we should do. And I was kind of skeptical, but man, it's just been a joy. It's so much more fun than just the traditional Facebook page that doesn't have the reach that these things do. And it's just there's not as much engagement because of the way Facebook's algorithms work. So this is a really cool way to get right in there and hang out. And we definitely do that.
And let's see. Do we have time for one more?
I'd love one more.
Great. So let's have one more that ends on a bit of a conundrum and a question. This comes from our serial killer memorabilia episode. Stephen P. writes in and says, hi, guys. First of all, thanks for the great podcast. You've played a big part in me moving from watching TV to listening to all kinds of stuff I'd never heard otherwise. Yeah, cut the cord, Steve. Just a quick thought, he says, about your questions about people making money off of other people's crimes. What about people writing about crimes, taking photos of crimes? They are undoubtedly making money off of the crimes of others, even if they're not actually selling bits and pieces. Many journalists would fall into this category as they document all the various horrors human beings perpetrate. An extension of this would be people writing about historical crimes. The Holocaust came to mind, and how would they figure in making money from others' crimes? Then, essentially, the question could be how much time has to pass before this stuff enters the public domain, or alternatively, where can we draw the line, if indeed a line can ever be drawn? Thanks again for all the stimulating content and for having interested me enough that I actually write in about something. Cheers, Stevie.
Thanks, Stevie. And, you know, to your point, we do get paid to make this show.
That's, you know, that's interesting because this is the second time in listener mail segment that this has come up, because I was thinking about how excellent these questions are, and I want you guys to briefly tackle it the way that I would analyze that is, or the way that I would process that is to say, the question about how much time has to pass is important, but I think more directly there's a question of what can be learned from learning about these things.
Yeah, from further examination, right? Or I don't know, just looking at it in a different light.
Right. Are we preventing future disasters or future crimes from occurring by learning more about this? What I'm saying is, yeah, there's obviously the exploitative, vicarious morbidity or catharsis that plays such a large role in crime overall. But there's also a phenomenal opportunity to teach, to educate, to prevent things from happening in the future. Because to that question about historical crimes, you know, there's – the old cliche is a cliche because it's true. If you forget history, you're just going to do it again.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
You're going to repeat it.
All those mistakes coming your way.
So thank you so much to Austin, Lisa, and Stevie, and everybody else who's written in that we haven't gotten to yet. I think we are overdue for a listener mail episode.
I think so. Absolutely. Those are fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And if you want to write to us or find us, you can find us on Instagram, where we're Conspiracy Stuff Show, Twitter and Facebook, where we're Conspiracy Stuff. You can go to stufftheydontwantyoutoknow.com and check out our new logo. It looks so awesome.
Thanks,
great
Paul.
Job, Paul. You're the best.
Paul and Pam. It was a collabo.
Oh, yes. You're right, Paul and Pam. And I planted the seed.
It's true.
And I really want just to put this out there. If we put out a Stuff They Don't Want You to Know hot sauce, would you buy it and consume it? Because I really want to make like a crazy hot sauce.
Or dare we say a T-shirt.
A T-shirt would be fine.
A tote.
A hoodie. A container of aluminum foil. Also, peek behind the curtain. Matt is a huge. He's a hothead. He's a hot sauce head.
Yeah.
He's got hot sauce in his bag swag.
Yeah. Yeah, is that's a thing?
Yeah, it's a
Beyonce it's a pop
who?
Culture reference.
Beyonce?
I don't know who that
Beyonce.
Is.
Beyonce?
But yeah, hot sauce is great, and I would recommend it, and I want to make some. So we're gonna see if we can do that. But we are going to try and hopefully have some stuff on a store soon that's easily accessible on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So look out for that.
Oh, also, real quick, Kyle Sherman wrote in on Twitter and said, the new social media read for the podcast is killing me. STDWYTK maybe could be STDWYTK. I just keep hearing STD and thinking sexually transmitted disease. Then I giggle. Maybe the read is genius because it becomes hard to forget. Well, now we have to keep doing it.
Yeah, that's the point. We knew you were going to write in because we had some psychics from a couple episodes back talked to us about that. We knew it was going to happen. So if you want to call us, the number is...
You know what we should do when we get T-shirts made? We should have this number printed on the back of the T-shirts.
Oh, yeah. Everyone.
That'd be a cool design. But what is it? I don't even know. 1-800-W...
The number is 1-833-STDWYTK.
Yeah, just think of sexually transmitted diseases.
W-Y-T-K.
Yeah. Then you can also find us on Instagram, of course, on our fantastic community page, Here's Where It Gets Crazy. You can also find us on Twitter. And that's it. We don't exist anywhere. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
You can say our show's name into a mirror 3 times in the dark.
Yeah, that's one of the best ones, but the absolute best one, thank you, Paul, wrap it up, is send us an email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.